Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
If you Google, you're probably still going to Google. If you Yahoo, you'll probably still do that. Same for Microsoft and Bing. So why all the fuss about the Yahoo-Microsoft deal today? Well, type this into any search engine you like. M-O-N-E-Y. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 29th of July. To take an old saying and update it for the search engine wars, if you can't beat them, do a deal with somebody else. See if that works. That's the approach the second and third place players in the internet search business have decided on. Assuming today's proposal gets the regulatory thumbs up, everyday Yahooers won't notice much of a difference. It's what's under the hood that's going to change. If you search on Yahoo's websites, it'll be with Microsoft's new Bing search engine. That's their entry in the beat Google at the search game sweepstakes. Today's deal will give the Yahoo-Microsoft team control over roughly 30% of global search traffic. Google, of course, has all the rest. Microsoft and Yahoo are hoping they'll have a better chance now to grab a bigger slice of the internet advertising pie, which is where that M-O-N-E-Y part comes in. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
The deal caps an on-again, off-again courtship that stretched over some 2 years. But today, Microsoft executives might well have been singing, or yodeling, their delight.
Yahoo!
Matt Rosoff is an analyst with Directions on Microsoft, a research firm devoted to covering the software giant. He says Microsoft's 10-year deal to become Yahoo's search provider won't threaten Google's dominance, but advertisers will take Bing's market share much more seriously.
When advertisers look at the search landscape and see a 70-30 split, it makes a lot more sense for them to split their budget between two relatively big players.
Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer predicted today the company will be able to use its data sharing agreement with Yahoo to better target search and advertising.
We'll be able to find new features and improve the relevancy of search results more quickly than ever.
Yahoo will be able to cut costs by ditching its own search development. CEO Carol Bartz says that will allow her company to focus on providing content. Ironically, Microsoft itself is a prime competitor in that arena, and both companies say they'll continue to compete vigorously outside their search partnership. But Bartz all but concedes neither had much hope of competing in the search business without joining forces.
This agreement provides both Yahoo and Microsoft the scale necessary to compete against Google, which dominates more than 70% of all search.
Microsoft analyst Matt Rosoff.
Microsoft can make sure that Google has to work a little bit harder and doesn't have as much time and as much money to pursue businesses that compete with Microsoft's core business.
And that, Rosoff says, is exactly what Microsoft has been desperately searching for. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
We went looking for what else this deal might mean for the two companies involved and for Google, their mutual competition. We tracked down Ina Fried. She's a senior writer with CNETnews.com. Ina, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Kai.
So, Microsoft and its new search engine Bing get market share out of this, right? What else do they get?
Well, they get market share in terms of business scale, but also in terms of they get to see a lot more of the questions being asked on the internet. One of the challenges in the search business, which makes it hard to rival Google, is actually the more traffic you get, the more you know, the better search engine you can build. There's sort of one of those virtuous circles to co-opt a business term here.
In other words, it's all about the algorithm, right? It's all about that search mechanism.
Right. Both on the algorithmic or the sort of search results you want, plus on the paid search, it's sort of the same thing. Advertisers are willing to pay more for bigger search engines, which means that Google makes more per search in addition to having more searches, which helps them feed their engine. And basically, both Microsoft and Yahoo need a bigger engine.
All right. Besides the bigger engine, though, what does Yahoo get out of this, since they're not really doing search anymore, their own search?
Well, they get a lot of the revenue for all the searches that will continue to be done on Yahoo's site. They're going to get 88 cents out of every dollar. And they don't have to spend the big bucks that it takes to constantly crawl the web, to keep trying to catch up with Google. So they get to basically use their resources elsewhere while still getting a lot of money. Don't forget, Yahoo has about twice the search volume that Microsoft has right now. So Yahoo will actually be getting more revenue from search than Microsoft for the time being and some time to come.
There is a customer habitability question here, right? I'm a huge Google user. I'm not likely to shift over to either Bing or Yahoo. How do you get people to break that habit and make Microsoft and Yahoo some money?
It's such an interesting question because, in the one sense, there's really no barrier to entry in that it's just as easy, one character shorter, two characters shorter, to type in Bing as it is Google. But as you point out, it takes something significantly better to make you switch. And when we all switched from Yahoo to Google, or at least most of us did, it was because Google was much better. And I think that's still the bar in terms of really attracting significant user shift.
Well, what is it about Bing that might make it competitive?
So right now, they're better in a few key areas. So they have some interesting technology in travel search, where you can not only find a flight, but it'll tell you if prices are likely to go up or down. They have some interesting things in both health search and product search. But it's not necessarily the kind of thing that's going to make you go, wow, this is so much better. And that's the challenge, is they've been focused on first catching up and then being a little bit better. But I think the bar is actually they have to be a lot better to really get people to switch.
So at the end of the day, is this really a competitor to Google, or is it just a convenient way for Google to be able to say, hey, you know what, there's somebody else out there. It's not just us. We're not the big evil empire. And Microsoft and Yahoo can sort of fight the good fight.
Well, it is the biggest potential challenge to Google in search, but they've still got a long way to go. I mean, even combined, you know, they're less than half the size of Google. So it's a more formidable competitor, but they're still a huge underdog when it comes to Google.
Ina Fried, staff writer at CNET. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
There is healthcare news worth a mention today. House Democrats have come to terms with each other. The fiscally conservative members of that party, known as the Blue Dogs, announced today they've been able to cut about $100 billion from the House version of the reform bill. That means it will pass a committee vote before their August recess. Probably won't pass the whole House, though, until after everybody gets back. On Wall Street today, kind of like yesterday, really, not a whole lot going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Big oil companies are well aware of the risks of doing business in Nigeria. Militants in the Niger River Delta attack their drilling platforms and pumping stations with some degree of regularity. This week, those oil companies have a less violent but perhaps more expensive issue to deal with. There's a new proposal to overhaul the expatriate oil and gas industry in Nigeria. Overhaul meaning make foreign oil companies pay more for the privilege of drilling. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Oil companies have been doing business in Nigeria for decades, but the government there says the current laws are outdated and slanted towards big oil. So it's proposing higher taxes and royalty fees on foreign oil companies, among other changes. Chris Grabowski edits the London-based Petroleum Review. He says Nigerian officials have been threatening these changes for years, but militant attacks on pipelines in the Niger Delta have made the legislation more urgent.
It sounds to me as to what the central government is trying to do is impose extra taxes on the oil companies and use the extra taxes to meet the demands of the people in the Delta.
Demands like sending a greater share of the country's oil revenues to the Delta region. Local tribes have also complained that oil operations are destroying their environment. Financial Times journalist Michael Peel has just written a book on the Nigerian oil industry called A Swamp Full of Dollars. He says given the country's history of political corruption, most Nigerians expect at least some of that extra tax money will go astray.
I think that a lot of people would see this as an attempt by the government not primarily to deliver goods to the people, but to grab more resources for itself.
The oil companies say the proposed changes will hurt profits and discourage future investment, but incentives to stay are powerful. Nigeria produces light sweet crude. That's the most desirable kind of oil since it's easy to refine. Shell, for one, currently gets 11% of its global production from Nigeria. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Crude prices dropped today, down about 5% amid reports U.S. consumers just haven't been using as much of it. There will come a time when we won't be able to use oil, either because it's all gone or because it's gotten too expensive. When that day comes, the clean energy business hopes to be ready. Actually, it hopes to be ready long before that day comes. But first, it needs to solve a fundamental problem: how to store the power it creates from wind or from the sun. Think batteries, really big batteries. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sam Eaton reports.
If the University of California at San Diego were a city, its energy policies would be among the most forward-looking in the nation. Its electrical grid is computerized for maximum efficiency, and virtually every parking structure here is plastered with giant solar panels. Byron Washam leads the university's effort to wean itself off fossil fuels.
We really are on the order of 5 to 7 years ahead of what the utility industry might be looking at in the not-too-distant future.
But Washam says the more UC San Diego relies on renewable energy, the tougher it is to maintain a consistent power supply. He whips out a laptop and logs onto a digital power meter for the solar panels we're standing under.
You see on this particular graphic where we had our typical morning of coastal fog.
Electricity output from the solar panels barely makes a blip on the chart.
And then at 9:30, the fog burned off. And within about a five-minute period, it just had a 5 times jump in production.
This is the Achilles heel of renewable energy. Solar panels and wind turbines only generate power when the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. But Washam says if you could store all that electricity in a giant battery so it could be used when it's most needed, problem solved.
It's the missing link.
And dozens of companies like Solar Reserve in Southern California are rushing to develop ways to store electricity. Bill Gould is the company's chief technology officer.
Our product uses the sun to collect energy, and then we store it as heat in large tanks filled with molten salt.
That heat is then used to generate power later in the day when demand peaks. Other companies are betting on technologies like massive lithium-ion batteries that could power entire cities, or compressed air from wind turbines that's stored in underground caves. Harish Kamath is with the Electric Power Research Institute, a utility trade group.
It's a brand new market with no significant players in it at the moment that dominate that market. So it's a very big opportunity for anybody who can rise to the challenge.
And an increasingly lucrative one. Today, University of California, San Diego announced it's taking bids to build a $3.4 million energy storage facility on campus. There are also billions of dollars in federal stimulus funds set aside for developing the technology. And it's been one of the few bright spots among venture capitalists, drawing more investment than any other clean energy sector in recent years. But Kamath says progress is still too slow.
What we really want to see are pilot projects, projects where you're actually addressing a need and showing that storage can do the job.
Like the one being planned in San Diego, Byron Washam takes me to the other side of campus where the new storage facility will be built.
This is going to be the Kitty Hawk of sustainability over the next 5 years.
Washam checks his watch and excuses himself for another meeting. The university's push to make renewable energy more dependable is attracting attention from all over the world.
This afternoon, I have a delegation from the leading Chinese battery storage manufacturers to come visit the campus.
So the word's out.
There's an expression in the South, and that is everybody smells meat of frying.
In San Diego, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
U.S. officials have been meeting with Israeli and Palestinian leaders this week. Israeli settlements in the West Bank are still a sticking point between the two sides, but overall, violence in the West Bank is at its lowest level in years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has relaxed some restrictions on travel through West Bank checkpoints, and that has brought with it some new commercial opportunities. Daniel Estrin reports now from the West Bank city of Jenin.
On the streets of Jenin, there are posters of dead militants. It's a reminder of a time about 7 years ago. Then, dozens of suicide bombers left for Israel, and Israeli soldiers imposed frequent closures on the West Bank. Today, with its U.S.-trained police force, Jenin is one of the territory's safest cities. Entrepreneurs are cashing in on the calm. One is trying to rebrand the city with the help of flat-screen TVs and espresso machines.
The atmosphere, the security, the situation is now it's okay. You can invest in this city.
Ziad Turabi is the son of a Mercedes dealer and a graduate of an interior design program at a Palestinian university. He and two friends took a risk unprecedented in Jenin. They invested $5 million in a landmark new commercial venture here, the Herbawi Home Center, a palatial furnishings outlet that stretches over five floors. Traditional Arabic music pipes through the speakers in cavernous showrooms full of sofas, refrigerators, and deluxe chef knives. Only a handful of customers are here, but Turabi is patient. He says there are plenty of Palestinians who are well off, but they're barred from entering Israel to shop.
We feel really that the people need this kind of business. So we find the people have money, want to spend, want to buy something good, and don't find nobody can offer them.
Turabi's enterprise is the first of its type in the entire West Bank. People here are used to trudging through open-air markets and small strip malls. Turabi's store offers a free delivery service, a generous U.S.-style returns policy, and one-stop shopping for a wide range of foreign brands like Pyrex and LG. Down on the first floor, Taisir Samara is sitting on a $1,400 sofa that he thinks he'll buy. Samara works as a building contractor inside Israel. But most people in Jenin don't have coveted Israeli work permits or the higher salaries that go with them. That may be why business has been slow since the store's grand opening 3 months ago. But the Herbawi Center isn't the only thing to boost Jenin's economy recently. For the past 2 months, the outdoor markets of Jenin and other West Bank towns have filled every weekend with about 500 Arab Israelis who have just been allowed to go on shopping sprees in the Palestinian territory. Until recently, Israel banned them from these cities. But the governor of Jenin, Musa Kadura, says the local economy won't be saved by these Saturday outings. He points out that the Israeli checkpoint is closed the rest of the week, and he doesn't have much hope for the Herbawi Home Center either.
Herbawi is beautiful. It would be more beautiful if there were people inside. I think it's a bad investment right now.
Herbawi's CEO, Ziad Turabi, has more faith. He and his partners plan to open this year in other West Bank cities. And they're excited that their example is encouraging other Jenin storekeepers to gussy up their display cases and more aggressively promote their merchandise. It may seem odd to be excited about your competition, but they all share the same mission: to revitalize the city. In Jenin, I'm Daniel Estrin for Marketplace.
Coming up, cheap thrills on the road.
Most of us can't afford to fly anywhere for a vacation, let alone pay for a resort hotel or a trip abroad. But in my book, road trips are just about the best form of vacation ever invented.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, it was a close-run thing, but the Dow Industrials did manage to keep its head just above the 9,000 mark today. 9,070, the closing price, down 26 points, about 0.2%. The Nasdaq nudged down 7 points, 0.3%, settled at 1967. The S&P 500 nicked off 4 points, 0.4%, wrapped at 975. Tech shares dragged the markets lower. Investors responded to the Microsoft-Yahoo deal we mentioned earlier by driving Yahoo down 12%. Microsoft shares moved the other way, gained nearly 1.5%. Search giant Google, the direct competitor of the two, it gave up 0.8%. Today, bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note nudged lower, 3.66%, the number there. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee examines climate change and national security. The National Alliance to End Homelessness continues its annual conference in Washington. According to organizers, more than 2.5 million people will be homeless at least one night in any given year. And industrialist Henry Ford was born on July 30, 1863. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. More than a dozen world records have been broken at the Swimming World Championships in Rome this week. Michael Phelps actually lost a race in one of his specialties. A lot of the credit, or the blame, depending on how you look at it, goes to the next generation suits that swimmers are wearing. Swimming's international governing body has had just about enough of it. Joel Steger is the director of the Councilman Center for the Science of Swimming at Indiana University. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Tell us about these suits they're wearing now. This is beyond what they were wearing in Beijing just last summer.
Yeah, to a certain degree it is. Probably the best way to describe it is that there's more polyurethane, more neoprene-like material on the suit, pretty much from head to toe now.
And the Swimming Federation just this week said, nuh-uh-uh.
Well, we've been going back and forth. They said nuh-uh-uh some time ago, and then they reversed themselves, and then they came back and did it again here recently.
So the suits are out, and you can only wear them for men waist to, knees, I guess, and for women from shoulders to knees. But the real question is, what does this mean for the business of swimming? How's that going to change what happens for the rest of the competitive swimming world out there?
Well, everybody was waiting to see how FINA was going to deal with this issue.
FINA, the Swimming Federation.
FINA is the international governing body for competition. And as they go, so will everybody else. So the high school federations, USA Swimming, the international or national local governing bodies, everybody's waiting to see what FINA is going to do with this issue. And from a business perspective, that's the base of the pyramid. That's where the money is changing hands.
That is high school swimmers and college swimmers and master swimmers such as yourself going out and spending, instead of $40 a pop, $600 a pop on these high-tech swimsuits.
Yeah. Nobody at the international level is actually paying for the swimsuits. So you're only looking at maybe several hundred athletes at the international level, and they're getting them all free. But when you start looking at the base of the pyramid, we estimate that there may be as many as 500,000 competitive swimmers in the United States. So that's a pretty broad base.
So let's do that math. 500,000 times 500 a swimsuit is in the millions of dollars, many millions of dollars.
Hundreds of millions of dollars, yeah. And the routine is, within the culture of swimming, is that a suit is purchased at the beginning of the competitive season and there's a practice suit. But somewhere along the end of the competitive season, during the championship season, everybody goes out and buys a new suit.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of the threat from Bob Bowman, Michael Phelps' coach today, saying, you know, I'm going to advise Michael just to sit out some of these events and let him see who actually comes to a swim meet now?
Well, it's the big dog has finally barked. Well, I think the athletes are finally recognizing that their commitment and their efforts and the coaches' innovations, et cetera, are second to what you're wearing now. And all of that is very hard to assess. And so I think now the athletes are finally starting to resent the question, well, so what suit did you have on?
Is this a little bit like the steroid question in baseball? Is it sort of technology doping?
Absolutely. And interestingly enough, it didn't come from the swimmers. In other words, the majority of the swimmer community would vote against the suits. This came from the corporate world, really, rather than the community itself.
Have we heard from the corporate world since these new rules have become at least semi-official?
Oh, yeah. There are many suits being discussed, and they aren't swimsuits. They're legal suits against one group and versus the other group in terms of how this is going to damage their incomes, et cetera.
Joel Steger, he's a professor of exercise physiology at Indiana University. He's also the director of the Councilman Center for the Science of Swimming there. Professor, thanks a lot.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Summertime means vacation for most of us, hanging out with the family, standing in line maybe at the airport, or hitting the open road for destinations unknown. That's where commentator Robert Reich is heading, down the highway.
This summer, road trips are back, mainly because most of us can't afford to fly anywhere for a vacation, let alone pay for a resort hotel or a trip abroad. But in my book, road trips are just about the best form of vacation ever invented. In a few days, I'm heading across America on my own road trip, driving with my eldest son, Adam, and his huge mongrel of a dog, Herb. It's not a vacation exactly. Adam needs another driver. But when he asked, I jumped at the chance. First of all, I love driving across America. Done it 6 or 7 times now. You can't see anything of this country from 5 miles up, but on the road, especially when you get off the interstates, you can see it in all its beauty and craziness, its crassness, and its charm. And you can't help but understand it just a little better. The other thing I like about road trips is you have a chance to talk. After all, your favorite CDs or public radio can carry you only so far. A long road trip lets you hang out with someone and bring up whatever is on your mind, and lets them do the same. Something about going a long distance as driver or front seat passenger, eyes staring straight ahead, that relaxes the mind and the tongue. And it also is okay to be silent for long stretches, which can be its own kind of intimacy. Now, I don't want to minimize the bad consequences of this lousy economy. Too many Americans can't even afford a road trip, let alone a fancier summer vacation. But in many ways, the economy is causing us to slow down, and that's not all bad. There are pleasures to be had, for example, in taking a few days with your kid and maybe a big dog, and doing nothing all that special except listening to music and talking and looking at the country.
When he's not behind the wheel, Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Wherever you are headed this summer, we'd like to hear from you. Write us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a lesson in political marketing, I guess you could call it. President Obama's grassroots organizing group that sprang up out of the campaign Organizing for America has sent an email to supporters with a pitch that goes like this. Send us $1 a day until a health care bill passes. The email says that'll prove to critics they can't outlast reform, that there will be plenty of money to pay for lobbying for any kind of overhaul. Of course, it doesn't answer the question of what supporters are supposed to do and what happens to the money if health care never passes now, does it? That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 26 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 7 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 eased down 4 points, 0.4%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, a new ad campaign pokes fun at high fashion.
New Yorkers make a point with humor and a little bit of aggression, and that's the tone that that we took.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.